from KXJZ in Sacramento. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Lake Tahoe could see hundreds of new piers over the next couple of decades. Supporters say more boat access is needed, but opponents say that's bad news for the lake. You'll find out more today on Insight. Also today, a string of conductors are publicly auditioning for music director of the Modesto Symphony. The latest will tell you what it's like applying for a job with hundreds of people literally watching your back. Plus, you'll meet Capital Public Radio's new GM. He's a longtime commercial radio executive who ran KFBK in the 80s when Rush Limbaugh was its local morning talk show host. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, an important job interview with crowds of people listening and watching. Also, a man who steered a commercial news talk station to market domination takes over Sacramento's public radio stations. You'll meet him later. First, the surface of Lake Tahoe could be getting a lot busier over the next couple of decades. The lake's planning agency is set to approve hundreds more piers, boat slips, boat ramps, and buoys. It's a controversial issue. Some Tahoe property owners would like more boat access, and they say the lake can handle the increase that would be allowed under this plan. But others, including environmental groups, say Lake Tahoe is in trouble and doesn't need more motorboats because of the pollution and noise they cause. We're going to look at both sides. Let's start with Julie Reagan of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. She's communications director. Julie, welcome to Insight. Why does your agency think Lake Tahoe needs hundreds more piers, boat ramps, boat slips, and buoys?
Well, this is a very important issue, Jeffrey, and I'm so glad we have the opportunity to talk about it. First of all, let me explain my agency's role. As the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, we were created in 1969, and since that inception of our bi-state agency, we have really helped protect Lake Tahoe from rampant runaway development. So no one wants to protect the shore zone more than we do here at the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. What's happening, there's a lot of history here with the shore zone, and this is the third environmental analysis we've done since the late 80s to try to arrive at new regulations about how many piers and buoys there should be. So it's really not a question of if we believe there should be more or less, but we're doing an environmental analysis to look at the future 20-plus years out in terms of how can we protect Lake Tahoe, have rules that are more effective, that are based on science, and that are legally defensible, because the rules that we have today are not. Studies have shown that we need to change our rules, that the impacts of piers can be mitigated if particular standards are taken. So we have to change the rules, and it's certainly very controversial because people come at this from all different perspectives, and it is a very emotional issue as well.
Yeah,
but we want to do what's best for the lake.
Well, you have to change the rules, but again, my question, why add hundreds more piers and other forms of boat access?
Sure. Well, if folks want to take a look at all the alternatives that are being analyzed, they can go to our website at trpa.org, and they can look at the range of alternatives. There are six plus. There's alternatives 1 through 6A, and all of those alternatives look at different scenarios, some of them with up to 631 more piers, and some of them actually with a reduction of piers. So there is a range that was analyzed, but the program that we're bringing forward for the consideration of our governing board, that is the proposed program, would be alternative 6A, which would be a potential increase, a maximum cap of 220 new piers and 10 new public piers. But that never has to be reached, of course. That would be the absolute maximum with a go-slow approach of about 10 piers per year. So the idea behind this is that we need to analyze what would be allowable in this 20-year planning horizon.
Is there a lot of demand for more boat access on Tahoe?
We found that there's demand all the way around for certainly property owners that have been waiting for about 20 years to really know definitively whether they would be allowed to build a pier. There are about 1,700 or so shoreline properties around Lake Tahoe. And for almost 20 years, a lot of folks have not been allowed to pursue an application for a pier. There's continued access issues for boating. Look around Lake Tahoe at Northern Nevada and Northern California. These are a couple of the fastest growing areas in the country. Where will people want to come and recreate? They'll want to come to Lake Tahoe. So we would be derelict in our duties if we weren't planning ahead for 20 years at the increased demands on the lake. And we want to do it in a way that's responsible for the lake and that works with the community.
If the agency's favored plan is accepted, is approved, how much boat traffic would it encourage if all of those piers and boat slips and so on were built?
Well, what we've done is analyze impacts from new piers and new buoys on the lake. And certainly, people do argue that a pier doesn't equal more boating access unless there's a boat lift on the pier. So all of that said, we're looking at a potential increase of about 1.5% up to a 30% increase of boating traffic. And some of that's going to happen whether or not this plan is approved or not. Because, again, we have been struggling for 20 years to bring closure to this debate, knowing that consensus is impossible. We're trying to find middle ground. Our whole desire behind this issue is to find middle ground between those who think we should have no more piers and those who think we should have many hundreds more. We're trying to find middle ground that is based on science.
Julie Reagan of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. We're joined now by Rochelle Nason, who's Executive Director of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, which doesn't like the look of this plan. Rochelle, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why do you think expanded boat access to the extent of this proposal would be a problem for Lake Tahoe?
Well, we think what this plan misses is that buoys and piers, by their very nature, are built on something that's public land, that's a public resource, and that is the very lake bed of Lake Tahoe. The plan's priority should be protecting the resource. We don't need more pollution, more noise, more congestion, or loss of scenic vistas, and that's what we're looking at when we look at thousands of new buoys and hundreds of new piers. And I have to disagree with something that I've heard here, that this would be a maximum of 230 piers. In fact, that's the number that would be allowed over the coming 23 years, but this is really a plan that could extend even further into the future, and ultimately we would see 400 or more piers, we believe.
How do you know, or why do you think that building all of these piers and these other forms of boat access would cause the problems that you say they would cause?
If you look at the document itself, it describes significant increases in pollution, and the mitigation is really nothing but wishful thinking. There's really no description of how these impacts are going to be handled. The shore zone of Lake Tahoe is already a very congested and, in places, very dirty and noisy place, and this is a plan that makes those problems much, much worse and does not protect the public interest in keeping Tahoe blue.
Julie Reagan of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency said that the agency's interest is in protecting Tahoe from rampant runaway development, I believe her phrase was. Do you accept that?
Well, no. It should be. It's really their mission, but we feel they're not living up to it.
Julie Reagan, Rochelle says that Tahoe is already dirty and congested. Surely adding more piers, more capacity for boats, can only make it dirtier and more congested.
Certainly, and I appreciate Rochelle's comments, absolutely. I think it's important to keep in mind that our role at Tahoe is really one that is to develop this equilibrium. Some people refer to it as a balance between the various interests that exist. It's not an easy job, and it's difficult. So certainly we're faced with a big controversy right here. Looking at the data, though, we're looking at potential increases in particulate matter. If you analyze all the research, and there's a lot of science that's a part of this document, with improvements in boating technology, we're not projecting big increases in hydrocarbon pollution or NOx emissions, but particulate matter we are concerned about. And this week we have a series of meetings throughout the month of January, actually, where we're going to lay out more details related to some of the mitigation programs, a program we're calling our Blue Boating Program that we believe can address what potential impacts could exist. But truly, any rule that we have in place must be legally and scientifically defensible. We can't just ban piers because we don't want any more piers. We have to make sure that is justifiable in a court of law, and that's what we believe this plan does.
Rochelle, could you address that issue of the legal defensibility?
Well, as I said, the owner of this resource is the general public, and there is absolutely no obligation on TRPA's part to permit the use of this public resource in a way that damages it, which is what is being planned. Blue boating sounds like a good idea, and we'd be very supportive, but just going with the hope that that people are going to voluntarily find ways to reduce their emissions and use that to offset the addition of thousands of new buoys and hundreds of new piers is just not realistic, and it's not scientifically defensible, nor is it legally defensible.
Rochelle Mason is with the League to Save Lake Tahoe. Julie Reagan is with the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. Let's bring in a third guest. She's Jan Briscoe, Executive Director of the Tahoe Lakefront Owners Association, which supports the allowing more piers and other means of boat access on Lake Tahoe. Jan, thanks for joining us.
And thank you for having us.
How many, in your opinion, in your experience, how many Tahoe Lakefront property owners support an expansion of the order that we're talking about here in the number of piers and boat ramps on the lake?
Well, certainly, when you start to look at the real numbers out there, property owners have been under a moratorium since 1982 for even being able to apply for a new pier or additional buoys in fish habitat. And so there is some pent-up demand for access to the process. We are hoping that while no one is contemplating that there be a pier on every single parcel around Lake Tahoe, that property owners have access to a well-thought-out, incentive-based approach to this planning effort. And getting people to buy into the idea that we can have environmental improvement while having additional piers and buoys on Lake Tahoe is certainly something that we have endorsed for a long time.
I'm looking at a map of the existing piers and the proposed sites for new piers at Tahoe. And if this map is correct, it says that there are currently a total of 768 piers at Lake Tahoe. Why would there be a need to add any more?
Well, one of the missing components here, and with all due respect to my colleague from the league, the Lake Tahoe is encircled by right around 1,400 privately held parcels. So the property ownership along the shoreline that extends out to low water in both California and Nevada is private. And since 1971, in fact, the ownership was around 17% public, and today it's 47% public. So you can see that the public acquisition of the shoreline has been increasing since 1971, but that still leaves 53% in private ownership around Lake Tahoe. And those people, in our opinion, have the right to wharf out to navigable water. Piers and buoys are not inconsistent with the public trust in both California and Nevada. And so it's basically having an ability to try to get people to cooperate, to go in together on a pier, to use community piers when appropriate, and to be able to have reasonable boating access. Just like the public wants to have access to the shore and to boating and to boat ramps and marinas and that kind of thing, so too do people who have ownership along the shoreline be able mm-hmm. to have piers and buoys and amenities like that.
Earlier, Rochelle Mason said that this is a public resource, and that's at the foundation of her argument that that there's no place for all these extra piers on Tahoe. Is it a public resource?
Well, it's a public resource, and it's also a private resource. It's like Julie Reagan said, it's a balance. It's an equilibrium, trying to find that balance between allowing an approach to development along the shoreline, whether it be for the public amenities or for the private. It really needs to be thought of as a resource that we have to manage appropriately, and we've always been supportive of environmental improvements. In fact, lakefront owners have funded over $500,000, almost $1 million worth of mitigation funding through the Fisheries Mitigation Fund since 1987 when this plan came into play. So we have been doing our part to fund some of these mitigation programs.
Our next guest is Roger Rosenberger, chair of the Tahoe Area Sierra Club, which is opposed to adding piers to Lake Tahoe. Roger, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How would you write a plan for the shoreline of Tahoe when it comes to the addition or I guess perhaps even removal of piers, buoys, boat slips, and so on?
Well, I think that, Jeffrey, first I need to provide the context for what I would say on that, because we're not against boats and buoys and piers, except as it relates to the circumstances of Lake Tahoe. Most of your listeners probably, as I do every time they drive over into Lake Tahoe, see this beautiful lake reflecting typically blue skies and looking like a gem within the mountains. And they say, well, isn't that gorgeous? And isn't it wonderful that we have a unique and beautiful place that we see? But what they don't know, and what I didn't know until I got involved in looking at all the things happening in the lake, is that fabulous clarity is disappearing. And while the TRPA has been working hard to improve the clarity for 40 years...
The TRPA being the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency.
Yes, the regional planning agency that Julie is representing today. While they have been working for 40 years to restore the clarity to where it was in 1968, which was just over 100 feet. You could see down 100 feet. They would drop a disc about the size of a frisbee into the water and watch it until it disappeared. And in 1968, when we started the process of saving the lake, you could see that disc down over a little over 100 feet. Today, you can see approximately 70 feet down. So in a little less than 40 years, we've lost 30 feet. Now, what this means is that we're losing the battle to keep Lake Tahoe a precious place. So going back to your question about how much development should we add at this point in time, our answer is simple. As soon as we start seeing Lake Clarity stabilize first and then improve, then we can talk about further developing Lake Tahoe.
Jan Briscoe, could you respond to that, please?
Well, one of the big questions I have of that philosophy is, how are we going to fund programs like that? How are we going to know when we've achieved that ability to add additional development? You know, when do we ever have everything in a perfect world? That would be in a perfect world. And quite frankly, we're going to have continuing impacts regardless of whether we have additional piers and buoys at Lake Tahoe. And we certainly shouldn't be holding people hostage for something that may or may not ever come to pass in the future. And
but isn't the clarity of the lake fairly easy to measure?
It isn't a result of piers and buoys, I can tell you that.
Okay, Roger, is it or is it not?
Well, actually, I don't know the answer to that. What we do know, though, is that lakes that do not have the level of development like Tahoe around them are doing much better. A typical example being Crater Lake, which is just a few hours north in the Oregon. It is not seeing the kind of degradation that our lake is in clarity. What exactly causes it is a dilemma, because we don't have any simple answer. It seems to be most related to the amount of human activity around the lake. And so what we need to do is keep working, as TRP has been working, until we see results that we want. I, however, cannot say that we should develop and hope the lake clears up someday. That we do not find as an acceptable goal.
Jen?
Well, it's one of the things that we have already existing around Lake Tahoe. We are not a national park around the shore of Lake Tahoe, nor are we going to be. We have an agency that Julie, I think, very succinctly said that they are in charge of finding that balance between the built environment and the natural environment. We have been making huge progress For instance, the two-stroke ban from a couple of years ago when two-stroke engines were banned. Lakefront owners got 100% compliance within the first year. We found a huge improvement in the water clarity at that point in time. The main reason we have declining water quality, with all the reports have said, is because of the in-stream flows, the flows and the sediment that come down the creeks and streams. I think that should be our top priority, to put our efforts toward the biggest impacts, the biggest benefits that we can find in those areas where we're finding the biggest impacts.
Rochelle Mason, do you agree?
No. I would agree with Roger, that what we should be doing here is getting some improvements before we allow things that could cause more damage. People will remember that it wasn't long ago that we had a catastrophic event associated with the construction of a pier in the Kings Beach area, where we had an enormous amount of sewage flowing into the lake. A single incident like that can cause a tremendous amount of damage to water clarity.
Jen, you're the executive director of the Lakefront Owners Association. What about people who own property in the vicinity of Tahoe but who are not on the lakefront? Do they have a common position on this issue?
Well, those people, in terms of facilities or in terms of access, are you talking about?
People who don't own property that's actually on Lake Tahoe and who don't own a pier that's on Lake Tahoe.
Well, I'm not exactly sure of I hear from a number of people who are in that situation, but when you have you have access at various points around Lake Tahoe, the tremendous pressure that is put on our existing facilities such as boat ramps and beaches and marinas and that kind of thing, that's where you get into your increasing your potential for additional access to Lake Tahoe for boating and launchings and things like that. I think everybody, as we get more and more pressure on Lake Tahoe, we're challenged with the need to provide that access and for fair share access for everyone to be able to access around Lake Tahoe appropriately with the right environmental focus. I think that's everyone's wish, and so that we can all coexist equally up here. And certainly, I think that people who are coming to Lake Tahoe, whether it's for the first time or whether they've come their entire lives, we all have that stake in Lake Tahoe to make sure that it remains as beautiful as we possibly can. And let me just say that lakefront owners, families along the shore, are the ultimate caretakers. They're the ones who save lives by rescuing people they see in distress. Their piers provide safe harbor for boaters in distress or swimmers. They are picking up trash constantly and making sure that they can preserve as much of that beauty as possible.
Roger, do you agree that overall the lakefront property owners are caretakers of the lake?
Well, I would hope that they do in the sense of what Jan suggested, and picking up trash is obviously good. However, I think we have to all say that the burden of proof on whether we're going to develop Lake Tahoe further has to be, the benefit of the doubt has to be given to the lake, because the lake is suffering. And each of us, I think, have to give up something now so that the lake can restore itself in the future.
I realize that with this plan that we're looking into the future, and ultimately who really knows what's going to happen. But let me put two versions of the same question to each of you. Jan, if you could be assured that adding all of these piers and buoys would cause problems for Lake Tahoe, would degrade the quality of the lake and its ecology, would you change your position on the plan? Would you support a scaling back in the approval of piers and buoys on Lake Tahoe? And like I said, I'm going to pose the opposite question to Rochelle and Roger.
Well, we feel we already have scaled back. We have compromised. We originally started at 700 piers, then we were down to 400 and something piers, and now we're down to 230 piers. We feel we can get there through an incentive-based approach. We also have a very go-slow allocation process, so I think we've already done that. And I'm hoping that, you know, when we start to look at actually instituting some of these mitigation programs, that we have a very good handle on how that money is spent and how our monitoring and evaluation processes will work. I think that's where we'll really get, I think, more buy-in from all factors and all sections of people who are interested in this issue is to make sure that we have good mitigation protocols and we can actually identify and assess how well or how poorly they're working and make appropriate decisions based on that.
And Rochelle and Roger, if you could be shown that in 20 years' time adding all these piers did not have a negative impact on Lake Tahoe, would you then be okay with adding all those piers and boat slips? Let's start with Roger.
Well, I would be certainly open to adding some, the way you put it. However, there is more to just the lake than just the Lake Clarity. There's the feel of the lake, and whether that feel is one of Mother Nature or one of all of our desires to build things and project them out into the lake. And so I would say that once we have, if we have something that, that protects the lake and its clarity, then we go into this negotiating process about how much human development do we allow and still retain the pristine nature of that gorgeous lake.
Rochelle, same question to you.
Well, we very much support the use of Lake Tahoe for boating, and we do think that there are places where piers may be perfectly appropriate. There are certainly places where additional buoys could be permitted without doing damage. So we're supportive of a reasonable plan. What's important, a reasonable plan that protects the public interest in Lake Tahoe. The problem with this plan is it's really predicated on making sure that every shore zone owner who physically can build a pier will ultimately have that option. That is hundreds of additional piers, and the number of buoys is just beyond all reason here. The ultimate property owner here is the public, and their interest needs to be protected.
And Julie Reagan, we'll wrap this up with you. What happens next?
What happens next is a series of meetings. We have them here at the lake. Actually, tomorrow evening, we have a workshop with the community to explain all the facts and to let people, again, make their own judgments about this. We're expecting a vote of our governing board on January 31st, and all of these meetings are open to the public. There's a schedule on our website, as I mentioned. We encourage people to take a look at the information, to attend the meetings if possible, if not, to communicate by email or letter. But our board will vote on the adequacy of the environmental document and the proposed program and ordinances going forward. If they decide to vote, that will be their choice, of course. They could decide to vote at a later time. That's certainly one of the discussions we're having right now. But I do want to say definitely that my agency, the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency, is working with all of our partners, many of whom are in this interview, on our environmental improvement program to continue to improve Lake Clarity. And we do believe that we're on the right track. The clarity of the lake was in a nosedive and hit an all-time low around 1996-97 of about 64 feet, and now we're currently at about 72 feet. This isn't something that you fix in one day, 1 hour, 1 year, or even 5 years. Most of the damage was done at Lake Tahoe before the TRPA even existed in the 50s and 60s. So it's a long-term process, and we hope this plan, and we believe that this plan is consistent with that effort.
Okay, well, thank you all very much. We'll keep an eye on this. I appreciate you all very much for joining us. That was Julie Reagan of the Tahoe Regional Planning Agency. You also heard Jan Briscoe of the Tahoe Lakefront Owners Association, Rochelle Nason of the League to Save Lake Tahoe, and Roger Rosenberger of the Tahoe Area Sierra Club. Thank you all very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks
so much.
You're listening to Inside from KXJZ. Coming up, a string of conductors are publicly auditioning for music director of the Modesto Symphony. The latest will tell you what it's like applying for a job with hundreds of people literally watching your back. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Some people can't listen regularly to the radio at 2 p.m. If that's you, consider our online archive. It's at capradio.org/insight. When you apply for a job, there's usually just one or two people on the other side of the table posing questions, but orchestras sometimes audition candidate conductors in a very public way. They invite them to take the baton for an actual concert with paying customers, and that's what the Modesto Symphony Orchestra is doing this season. Previous music director Daryl Oney stepped down last May. The orchestra has five candidates to replace him. The latest is José Luis Novo. This weekend, he conducts the Modesto Symphony in three concerts. He joins us. José Luis Novo, welcome to Insight.
Hello, Jeffrey.
What's it like auditioning for a job in such a public way?
Well, it's as you are well saying, it feels like you have to be ready to be scrutinized publicly. In many ways, it's like what politicians go when they are up for election. You know that people are going to look at your best, but also at your worst side. So you need to be ready to not be afraid of showing who you are.
Has the Modesto Symphony told you what part these concerts play in their overall evaluation of you and the other candidates? How important are these concerts, and how would they incorporate that into their decision?
The concerts are obviously a very important part of the search because it's the moment where the conductor really proves what kind of relationship he or she can establish on the stage with the musicians and with the audience. So every orchestra that runs a music director search values that moment very much just because of the reasons. I think that it's definitely a very important part of the process, and the orchestras and institution is going to be giving that moment a lot of weight.
Does the fact that you're auditioning affect the way that you conduct, affect the way you talk to the musicians?
Not really. I think the only thing that it affects, it just brings to my attention a little more clearly that everything that you are doing is going to be judged. But in the end, that's very much what we as conductors do all the time. Every time that you step on a podium and you work with musicians, you are being criticized whether they tell you or not. So that really doesn't change that much in a process like this. So I'm not planning on changing the way I normally work with an orchestra. But I know that I will be careful in making sure that all what I do is at my best ability.
José Luis Novo is a conductor who's a candidate for music director of the Modesto Symphony Orchestra. He's conducting the orchestra this weekend, in three concerts with the Eroica Trio. Usually when people apply for a job, and you have an existing job, you do it quietly so that your current employer doesn't know what you're doing. But that's not an option when you're doing what you're doing. You're already the music director of two other orchestras. How do you handle that?
Well, the first thing that you need to do is to tell them before they find out publicly, because they are going to find out one way or another. So I went ahead and told the orchestras that I work with that I was a finalist for this job. That did not mean that that I was going to leave them, but I wanted them to know that there was another orchestra that was considering me for a music director position. Now, it's not uncommon for music directors to have multiple positions when the orchestras are of a certain budget, like Modesto. When you go to an orchestra of a considerably bigger budget and activities, is more difficult to have more than or be music director of more than three orchestras. But so, which means that they should not be completely afraid that if you were to be offered this new job, you would be leaving them.
Well, you're music director of the Binghamton, is that how it's pronounced?
Binghamton
mm-hmm. Philharmonic in New York State and the Annapolis Symphony Orchestra in Maryland. Would you, if you were hired by the Modesto Symphony, would you keep those two jobs as well?
That depends a little bit on the conditions and on the possibility of combining the three positions. I think there is a way to work them out if every institution would be willing to do so, and if that's what I would want to do as well. I think there are advantages to having a music director that is music director of all other orchestras, because it brings the profile of that person to a different level. When you have someone that is shared by other institutions, that means that other people also value his or her services as much. And also, it makes some of the aspect of internal aspect of the functioning of an orchestra easier. You can share resources in terms of library, guest artists, and so there are some important advantages of having a music director that is music director of other orchestras.
You're from Spain. Why did you move to the United States?
Well, I first came to the States to study for 1 year. I was lucky enough to get a Fulbright scholarship, and I came to study at Yale University. And then I liked it so much that I stayed as a student, and then I was offered some jobs, and ever since I've loved it here.
The program of the three pieces of music that will be in the concerts this weekend that you're conducting with the Modesto Symphony Orchestra include the Eroica Trio. It's an interesting looking program, and these are big names, the Eroica Trio. What do you think about the program that the Symphony Orchestra chose for you and the guest artists?
Well, the program was mutually chosen. The Eroica Trio was booked for this date, and this was the date that the Modesto Symphony offered me. So that was not a choice. And obviously, there aren't too many choices for pieces as when you have a trio of violin, piano and cello to play with orchestra. So the Beethoven piano, triple piano concerto was a logical one, and that was perfectly fine with me. The other two pieces in the program were mutually discussed when I was contacted, and of course the Modesto Symphony approved my suggestions. I suggested to do Schumann's Fourth Symphony because when I checked into the repertoire that the orchestra had done in the last years, there was only one piece by Schumann, the piano concerto. Mm-hmm. So I thought that it would be very interesting to do something that the orchestra had not worked on and that the audience had not been exposed to. So I decided to do a Schumann symphony. And the other piece by the Mexican composer Silvestre Revueltas, which is called Homage to García Lorca, I thought it would be a very good choice because of several reasons. One is because it's completely different style of music, which is a good thing to address when you are under a music director search. I think both the audience and the musicians need to know how comfortable you are managing different styles of music, and they need to be as much variety on your conducting mm-hmm. as possible. So this piece will provide that. On the other hand, also it's some music that brings a different level of complexity to the music. It's a smaller group in the orchestra. It's not a full symphony orchestra, but rather a more of a chamber orchestra-like version, which fit well in this program because with the Eroica Trio taking that much space on the stage, we are somewhat limited on the space on the stage. And also because it shows a very important factor in music, in how music comes about. Revueltas wrote this piece as an homage to the Spanish poet Federico García Lorca when the poet was executed during the Spanish Civil War. Revueltas loved Lorca's poetry, and he was devastated by his death. Mm-hmm. So he wrote this piece in homage to him. And this is how music comes about. It's all very personal relationships.
And finally, Jose Luis, you applied for this job last summer, and it might not be till next summer that you find out whether you've got it or not. That's a long wait for you and whoever else is relying on you.
Exactly. It's you have to be patient. You know that it's a very long process, but also you know that's also a guarantee of the orchestra making the right choice. If they were to choose this in a rush, it would most likely not be a good way to go about it. So you just need to know that's the way it goes, and you have to be patient.
Jose Luis Novo, conductor who's a candidate for music director of the Modesto Symphony Orchestra. He's conducting the orchestra this weekend in three concerts with the Eroica Trio. Jose Luis Novo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Jeffrey.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, you'll meet Capital Public Radio's new GM. He's a longtime commercial radio executive who ran KFBK in the 80s when Rush Limbaugh was its local morning talk show host. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For many years, Sacramento's most listened to radio station has been KFBK. It's an AM news talk station best known in the industry for its long association with Rush Limbaugh. KFBK was where Limbaugh established himself as a talk show host just before going national. One of the executives who steered KFBK through many dominant years is now head of Capital Public Radio, the Sacramento broadcaster that operates this station and six others. He's Rick Etchison. What are his plans for Capital Public Radio? What impact will his long experience in commercial radio have on his work in public radio? We'll find out. Rick, welcome to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to start working in public radio after so many years and a lot of success in commercial radio?
Well, a lot of it has to do with my commitment to Sacramento and to this community. I love Sacramento. I decided a long time ago I'm not going to leave Sacramento. I've had many opportunities, but I've always wanted to stay here. At the same time, the changes that have occurred in commercial radio have made it very difficult to provide the kind of community service that we used to do in commercial radio and that you still have the freedom to do in public radio. And that's part of the reason that this particular situation was so attractive to me.
Was KFBK back in the mid-80s doing the kind of public service that that you thought it should have been doing?
Boy, that's a tough question. Probably not. We were doing considerably more than most of the commercial broadcasters do at this time. But the pressures were very different on commercial broadcasters then than they are now. The pressures to become not only profitable but hugely profitable are very different than they were at that time. At that time, if you had a commercial station that was making 20 or 25% gross operating profit, you were doing really well. With the advent of publicly traded radio broadcasting companies, there's an enormous pressure on those companies to deliver 50% profit. And that changes the dynamics of everything you do, particularly in programming, which is very expensive.
Is that kind of profit margin realistic nowadays in commercial radio?
It's very common, yeah. Not only realistic, it's very common.
Did you and others at KFBK predict that Rush Limbaugh would become as successful as he has?
Well, a couple of us did. and we tried very hard to get the company that owned the station at that time to syndicate Rush.
But that was Group W.
That's correct. It was Westinghouse Broadcasting at the time. And, you know, it was a very novel concept. Syndicated talk was not doing very well in most of the major markets. And because of the nature of the economics of doing syndication, you really need to have the shows cleared in New York and Los Angeles and Chicago to be very profitable. It was deemed unlikely we could get stations in those cities to carry a syndicated show, particularly that was originating from Sacramento.
KFBK bounced backwards and forwards between being locally owned and being owned by a company elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Chancellor Media, which was a Sacramento company, bought KFBK in 1994, and you were involved in that, weren't you?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have been involved in that.
Am I right in saying that Chancellor was an important element in the ultimate construction of Clear Channel, that it became one of the building blocks of Clear Channel?
Yes, it was. The timing was such that eventually Chancellor became one of the major consolidators in the industry. In a couple of very short years, we became one of the largest owners of radio stations in the country. And in fact, we what became AM/FM Broadcasting, which was a combination of Chancellor and Evergreen Media, between the two, we at that time owned about 500 stations, which was about the same as Clear Channel owned at that time. So when Clear Channel acquired Chancellor/AM/FM, it essentially made it the 1,000-plus radio station operator that it is today.
By that time, the mid to late 90s, had commercial radio already started to drift away from what you thought it should be?
Yeah, and I have to plead guilty to having participated in that consolidation, which ultimately I think has led to the demise of much of the programming that I think is essential in local communities. We needed to, because of the flurry of activity to consolidate and acquire additional radio stations as quickly as you could, thanks to the telecom bill in 1994, which deregulated our ownership, we had to go public. We had to raise money in the public markets to fund those acquisitions. And changing the dynamics from being a privately held company to a publicly held company where you had to report your earnings on a quarterly basis dramatically changed the dynamics of how local radio stations operated.
What impact will your experience in commercial radio have on you now as an executive in public radio?
Well, one thing that I think my experience provides is financial stability. I mean, I keep a very close eye on the financial situation of the stations. There's a great deal that I would like to see us do, but at the same time, I recognize we have to keep our financial stability about us. And the disciplines in commercial radio, as far as marketing are concerned, are different. The competitive situation is different. And there are a number of different approaches to essentially the same business as there is in the public sector.
If you had been told back in the 80s or even in the 90s when you were at KFBK and Chancellor that one day you would become the boss at what was then just KXPR, what would your reaction have been?
I would have said I need more to do than that. But I've always been interested in public radio and particularly these stations. My interest has grown as the enterprise has grown and the influence that Capital Public Radio has grown as well into the surrounding area. You know, there's the guests you had on a half hour ago, you had a much more important conversation than you're having with me right now. What's happening at Lake Tahoe is really relevant to us in Sacramento. And what's happening in Modesto and Stockton is relevant to what's happening in Sacramento. And the whole Northern California community assimilates the Capital Public Radio's role in that is critically important. And that's again, one of the reasons why this situation is so interesting to me.
These are early days for you at Capital Public Radio, but do you have any plans yet that you can share with us for Capital Public Radio or public radio in Sacramento?
Well, I'd certainly like to see us expand our locally produced programming, shows like this, which are very expensive to do and very difficult to do in commercial radio. I would really like to see us expand our local news programs as well as the talk and entertainment shows. It requires more resources, and that's one of the things that I'll be working hard to do is raise additional resources.
But how do you do that within the constraints, the legal and aesthetic constraints of public radio?
Well, I think part of it's just a little bit of a different mindset as far as how aggressively do we pursue potential underwriters and major donors. There are a lot of people in this community that have the potential to step up if they see that a program is vital to the interests of the community, that have the ability to underwrite those things. And I'm confident that if we have a good plan, we can find people that will help us do it.
Public radio is more competitive nowadays than it used to be. You have markets now with more than one station, and that's the case in Sacramento with KQED broadcasting here. Is that a good thing, a bad thing, or somewhere in between?
Well, I think if you ask anyone in this building, they would say that's a good thing. It has caused everyone to look at the way we do things and hopefully do them better. I think that there are ways we can collaborate with those other public broadcasters and use our resources more wisely and ultimately provide a greater service to the community that way.
Rick Etchison is the new president and general manager of Capital Public Radio. Any final thoughts, Rick, as we wrap this up?
Well, it's been 3 weeks now, so I've got a lot to learn, and I'm really excited about it. I love this show. It's one of the things that has attracted me to Capital Public Radio.
Thank you. Well, Rick, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Again, that's Rick Etchison, the new president and general manager of Capital Public Radio. And that's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight interns get real responsibility and training. The only coffee and the only photocopies you'll make are your own. Find out more at capradio.org/insight. Coming up on the KXJZ stations, the American-style comic book became a mainstay for many African kids learning to read. Now, artists from Angola to Tanzania are capturing both the desperation and humor of life in Africa. That story in the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes Mark Jones, Natalie Breen, Jen Picard, and Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. One of the biggest issues Governor Schwarzenegger plans to address this year is health care. More than 6.5 million Californians have no health insurance, leading to higher deductibles and copays for those who do. Next time in Insight, experts tell you about problems with the current healthcare system and how they think it should be fixed. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.